Welcome to Hope Central's latest podcast. Please check out our website, hopecentral.org.au, after this message for any further information. We hope you enjoy today's message.
Today we are talking about faith blocker number three, the supernatural. I just thought this picture was so fantastic. That's going to be happening today. No, we're all getting changed, and it's going to, no. This is kind of like an image of what I don't want to see happen, but I do want to talk about this really interesting thing that the supernatural can become, is today, a stumbling block in people's journey for faith, which is really, I find, just almost hard to understand. But it works in this way. If you don't believe that the supernatural is possible, it becomes very difficult for you to seek God. So there are these roadblock kinds of things, like we talked a couple weeks ago about, like how evolution is getting in the way of people's belief, because they think, well, if we all evolved, then there must be no God. If there's no God, then what's the point of seeking? But then we discuss, well, if evolution isn't correct, then that reopens the possibility of a search for God. And in the same way, the kind of assumption that the supernatural is non-existent has created a block to people's faith that I'm hoping today we can talk about. Either for you, it's a block for your faith, or maybe it's going to equip you to talk to somebody else about how their faith is blocked. And then last of all, we're going to experience some of the supernatural miraculous here today. I want to start with this interesting story. I used to have this deal years ago, and it probably is still on, so you can talk to me. The deal goes like this. If you have a friend, a family member, or somebody that you know that is in hospital, that is near death, and they will, if they want me to visit them, I'll visit. You just need to call me, and then I'll come, right? So years ago when the church was smaller, I didn't get as many takers, so I was happy to sort of make that public. Here I've done it again. Oh, dear. We'll send Rad or someone else, Ash, you know. So these people ring me up. They've got a friend in hospital, terminal with cancer, well advanced. This lady was now in palliative care, no expected recovery whatsoever. Palliative care had involved treatment with morphine, so she was completely unconscious. The pain was too great. She was completely unconscious and had been unresponsive for 4 days. Like, nobody at all was getting a response from her. So they said, the family are happy for you to come. You want to come? I'm like, oh, okay, that's a, get that one off the deathbed. No challenge too hard. So I went down to the hospital. When I got to the hospital, there was a crowd of people waiting outside in the sort of the hallway kind of greeting welcome area. So I was like, we talked a little bit because they were changing the bedding and that kind of thing. Let's keep that a bit private. So I spent a little bit of time getting to know the family, getting them to know a bit of the story. And, you know, in the Australian way of becoming friends, I insulted their football side and things like that. And we were all, it's good. That's how you, I don't know if you know that, that's how you do it. So we were all enjoying that, and they said, you can come in. So I went into the hospital room, and there's this lady, very frail. She's lying on her side on the bed because they just keep turning her just, you know, for bed sores and blood flow and that kind of thing. So she's lying on her side. Her eyes are closed. She's completely unresponsive. And so I thought, well, this can't be too hard. So I grabbed a chair, hustled it up in front of her, face, and just said, hello, and I said her name. I'm a messenger from God, and I've just come to tell you some really important information that God wants you to know before you die, and it's about his love for you, and so I wanted to explain to you how that love works, and I want to tell you about Jesus. Do you want me to tell you more about this? And she nodded. Now, she hadn't done anything for anyone in 4 days, so all the people in the room were like, oh, she just nodded. So they're all kind of like, whoa, you know, and they get the brimmy tear thing, you know, it's just there. And so I said, great. So she's responding. And so I explained the gospel to her. And I said, now, as I've explained that to you, if you would like to receive Jesus as your Savior, can you please nod? And so she nodded again. So now everyone's just like, okay, you get the tingly up the spine thing, and you're like, whoa. So I pray. I said, listen, I'm going to pray, and then you pray in your heart while I'm praying, and then I'll say amen. So I prayed for her, led her to the Lord in that moment. And then when I finished, I looked up, and her husband was just bawling. He's in tears. He's on the other side of the bed from me. So I looked up and I thought, I think we need to pray for you too, Alex. So I reached across the bed and I said, let me hold your hand. So I grabbed hold of his hands. When you're in these moments, people just let you kind of be in charge. I don't know if you know that, you know, especially when you think you're a messenger from God. So I reached over, I grabbed his hands, and I started to pray for Alex. He's weeping. I'm praying for him. As we're praying, his wife, who has just become a Christian, lifts up her hand and places it on our hands. Now, she couldn't see. Her eyes were shut. That was behind her to the side. She places her hand right on top of our hands in her last act alive to pray for her husband. Now, everybody in the room was just bawling, you know, because these kind of moments, your emotions don't know what to do, so you just go to default bawling, crying, you know, just everyone's a mess. It's all happening. And so later on that day, she passed away. Then they called me up and said, can you do the funeral? And I said, that's fine. Sure, I'll do the funeral. So I said, to do a funeral, I need to come around and visit you and get the story so I can present her well. And so they said, that's great. So a couple days later, I went around to their house, sat down with them, and got the lady's life story. And that's when I discovered that she had been a witch her entire life. And I thought, gotcha, Satan. Snatch, hello. Oh, did you? He nearly got. Oh, no, it's just, sorry. It's a bit of a bravado. But she had spent her whole life searching for the spiritual truth in all kinds of places, but at the end was desperate for life and found it in Christ, I believe. Now I took that story then to the funeral and told the whole story at the funeral, full of people who did all kinds of white magic and all kinds of Wicca and all sorts of things. Everybody in the funeral was bawling. We go back to the house afterwards. Everybody's there. They're all fawning after me, asking for more stories about Jesus and talking to me and treating me like I'm some sort of messenger from God. And it was such a wonderful time. I'm in this environment, and all of these people are sensitive to the supernatural, and the supernatural meant so much to them. So how is it then that we can live in a world where so many people are blocked to the idea of the supernatural, that so many people are discrediting God because of the supernatural? And so I just wanted to talk with us about that today and then finish by talking about the way that Jesus worked the supernatural and what the message of the supernatural through Jesus was. Okay, so we all know sort of those kinds of things, but when I was a new Christian, I kind of thought everybody just kind of believed the miracles of the Bible like they were actual miracles. It wasn't until later that I discovered that the greatest miracles of the Bible are constantly under scientific scrutiny, that people are trying to disprove the supernatural events of the past. This, the great event that happens here is the exodus of the people of Israel as they leave Egypt, and the great miracle that God does, dividing an entire sea, and the whole people, 2 million people, go across this sea on dry land, and then once they're to the other side, the Pharaoh's army pursues them only to have the water collapse back on them and drown the entire army. And then, so I was thinking, this is an amazing thing, until I discovered that this was just an atmospheric event, that at certain times in every couple of hundred years, the wind blows just right down the Nile Valley and creates this sort of pressure system that pushes the water out of the Reed Sea, which is not the Red Sea, the Reed Sea, which is only about a foot deep. And then it creates this dry path of ground so that they could have gone out to the other side. So it wasn't a miracle at all. It was just science. And I thought, you mean that lucky moment every couple of hundred years when the wind blows just right, happened to have 2 million people backed up on the shore with an army pursuing them, when they walked across and a bunch of water 1 foot deep killed an entire army? Yeah, no miracle there. But this kind of thing is sort of in the discourse. There's people actually believe that the things that are miraculous in the Bible can be logically explained through science. So one of the books that you may not know about, there's a book called The Jefferson Bible. It was never titled that, but they call it that now. This is the title page from it: The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, Extracted Textually from the Gospels in Greek, Latin, French, and English, written by Thomas Jefferson, who was one of the founding fathers of the American Constitution, President of the United States for about 8 years. And he loved the teaching of the Bible and the morals of Jesus so much, but could not tolerate anything that was miraculous. And so he took the life teaching of Jesus and extracted every miracle from it, cut them out, and recreated the moral teaching of Jesus, since all the rest is just a bunch of gobbledygook. You know, it's not true, so why would we even bother paying attention to it? So let's have just this minimal Bible that's just about his teaching, which is kind of crazy. But then I've known other people. I was a massive science fiction fan, still am, growing up, and would read. One of my favorite authors was Isaac Asimov. So when his name would appear up on different books, I would take a look because I really love to read his stuff. And I found a book written by him, Asimov's Guide to the Bible. One of the great secular humanists of the last century, who's deceased now, but he was actually head of the Humanist Society, decided to go through the entire Bible and write secular applications for the stories there. And he said, if you with this help, you can properly read the Bible. That is, let's just get God out of it and let's draw some fairy fable tales from it that we can learn moral lessons from. Which I thought, see, people today, right now in our world, think like that. There are people that you're going to meet and talk to that are going to think that that's the way that you approach things, that there is no spiritual things. A lot of that thinking comes from a guy named David Hume. Now, David Hume was a philosopher from the 1700s, one of the most influential philosophers of the Enlightenment era that helped people retranslate their lives, which had been so spiritually influenced, into the logic of the Enlightenment so that you could learn to look through that the world through a modern lens. And he taught this. He says, a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, and as a firm and unalterable experience has established these laws, the proof against a miracle from the very nature of the fact is as entire as any argument from experience can possibly be imagined. Now, you're thinking somebody just assembled a bunch of words into a sentence, and that doesn't actually make sense. Okay, well, you got to go back a couple hundred years. Basically, what he's saying is there can't be miracles because miracles violate the laws of nature. And the laws of nature are the only things that we can really depend on, and they are inviolatable. So there can't be no miracles because then the laws of nature would have been violated, so they're therefore impossible. Which only makes sense if you believe that you can't violate the laws of nature. I say miracles are a violation of the law of nature. I'm happy for them to be accused and locked up on that accord. But he said it's an impossibility. In fact, he said later on, he said, it forms a strong presumption against all supernatural and miraculous relations that they are observed chiefly to abound among ignorant and barbarous nations. Or, if a civilized people has ever given admission to any of them, that the people will be found to have received them from ignorant and barbarous ancestors. So he says, the only reason why anyone would believe in a miracle is they are so uneducated, undeveloped, unevolved, that they don't know good from right, left from right, they don't know up from down, they can't tell anything. And so ignorant people believe miracles, people that know stuff don't. Now, what you may not know is that David Hume was a massive racist. He believed that the African nations, for example, were an unevolved subset of the human species and weren't due the normal rights and privileges that human beings were accorded. In fact, people used Hume to reinforce slavery for a couple of hundred years. So he believed that intelligent, evolved people couldn't possibly believe any kind of superstitious story. And if ever a story was believed, then there must be something wrong with that person. For them to think a miracle had occurred, there's something wrong with their mind. They are just a barbarian. Now, weirdly, that is now established truth in most universities in the Western world. People think that if you believe in a miracle, that there's something wrong with your brain. There's something wrong with you. So, okay. They put us in the class where they think it's Santa Claus, it's the Easter Bunny, it's the Tooth Fairy, it's Jesus. If you believe that stuff, you are the same naive, childlike person that doesn't understand the way things are. And I don't want to burst any bubbles, check the age of the children in the room. Let's just say that there is some difficulty in believing in the fairy tale, the Easter Bunny, the Santa Claus, the Tooth Fairy. If you want to believe that there is this mysterious fairy that gets rotted and decaying teeth from underneath your children's pillows to exchange for equally dirty money, which is also hygienic for bedtime things for children, then you let's just say you can, but they say that belief in those kinds of things is the same thing as believing in Jesus and his miracles out of the Bible. Now, I like this quote from House. He says, if you could reason with religious people, there would be no religious people. There is some mental defect among the people who believe any kind of religious philosophy or idea, anything to believe, anything spiritual, supernatural. There's something just wrong with us. That's a great faith to believe. Now, I would like then to ask, to summarize their point of view in this way. They say miracles don't happen because either it never happened, i.e. you're just fooled by the event, a dead person didn't really rise from the dead, you are totally wrong, that person, so it couldn't have happened because that person really wasn't dead, they were just really, really calm, they were using Bandhu Prindhu exercises that you can learn in Buddhism, calm your heart, like the ninjas I saw in the movie, and they weren't really dead, they were just sort of really restfully sleeping, and then they woke back up later. But also, the people then say, well, if it was miraculous, then there's probably a logical scientific explanation for it, i.e. the wind blowing, the seas parting, and that's how it all happened, and, you know, so there's no miracle. Or they say it was some sort of coincidence, chance, or evolutionary forces. Like, we talked about the miracle a couple weeks ago about the human eye. The eye is so miraculous in its design and its function that people look at it and go, well, there's an example of the miracle God, and they say, well, that's just evolution at work, that evolution, giving time and chance, will produce these so-called miracles, but there are greater miracles to come as evolution completes us, even though evolution has no idea what's going on. Now, I would also like to say, to give weight to these people who disbelieve in the supernatural, that there is very good reason why they disbelieve the supernatural. And here it is. All of that Enlightenment teaching that we now receive grew in a time when the supernatural was being abused along with the superstitious. Let me explain myself a little bit. When a scientific person from the 1700s looked at the facts for miracles, they were so filled with nonsense that they went, who could believe this? This is crazy. Who really believes that by crossing your fingers, you can alter the course of human history? Or outcomes of elections? Or football matches? You know, like I said, when you cross your fingers like that, you're doing the mini version of a one that I like to do, which is like this. It causes more actual things happening. That's the symbol for prayer, in case you didn't get my joke. You got it. You just moved on quickly. Now, that sort of thing. I mean, you know, we today still say things like this. Somebody sneezes, we say, bless you. Why? Is it because you're so thankful for that gift of a sneeze? Like, wow, that spray was magnificent. I saw a rainbow in the mist. Like, no, but saying bless you was to seal people against the demonic that had exited the person in their sneeze. Right? Now you're thinking, well, that's crazy. Yes! So when science-minded people went, we are saying bless you to sneezes, they had reason to go, no, that's just dumb. Okay? Likewise, athletes that we know. There are all kinds of people who think the outcome of their sporting prowess depends on the placement of water bottles on the tennis court. Have you ever watched Nadal play? He's full of little ticks and things that he needs to do. He's got to put his hair just the right way. If he doesn't do that, he's not going to win the point. If he doesn't bounce the ball a certain amount of times, he's not going to win the point. If he walks out of court, steps on the line, he's going to not lose. So he's got to step over the line. He's got to be this foot first and that. And he's got all these little kinds of things that affect him. And I'm thinking, whatever it is, it's not working for him. Because, you know, whatever voodoo that Nadal has, it's not as strong as the voodoo or whatever that has to happen for Federer to win. Okay. One of my favorite athletes growing up was Wayne Gretzky, who was an ice hockey legend. And he had a thing about, you know, you got to have your ice hockey sticks that are standing up against the wall. None of them can cross because that's bad luck. And you got to line them all up. You got to have the right color underwear on. It's got to be all just like this. Otherwise, we won't play well and everything depends on it. Okay. There's also the all kinds of, you know, other superstitions that we find still today. Look out, there's a black cat. Yes, relevant somehow. I don't know. But apparently there's luck and misfortune if a black cat comes near you, especially if he's standing on a ladder that you're about to walk under into a rake. It's bad luck to step on the pointy end of a rake. For good reasons, you'll get hit in the head. Broken glass. And then there's that legend, step on a crack, break your mother's bank account. No, like it's, you. People believe the weirdest things. We used to chant things like that. They get into song lyrics. They become part of our life. Oh, you broke a mirror. Now you have 7 years bad luck. How? So there's also the church did a lot of really bad things when it came to the miraculous that they had for a very long time. In fact, still happens today. They preserve holy relics, body parts, skull fragments, bone pieces, clothing worn, articles owned by previous saints or holy people, and they would use those things as touch points for the miraculous. So if you went to such and such cathedral, you knew that it had the, you know, the staff of Nicodemus, and so if you got Nicodemus's staff there and you touched that, then you were guaranteed your miracle. Or maybe it was the nail from the cross, or maybe it was a piece of wood from the cross, or a piece of thread from the garment of Jesus, or maybe it was from some saint that died somewhere along the way and they'd done miracles in their lives, so now if you pray to their deceased bones, then you'll get your miracles. There's all kinds of these things that are happening, and all of this time when people are going, is the supernatural even real? Here the church is filling the world with false, with ridiculous things. You can't pray to a dead saint. Sorry if you're Catholic that way, but I mean, I don't want to offend you. I want you to see that you need to be offended. So it's not just that, but people will go to, every now and then a statue starts crying, like weeping from the whatever's, and like things dripping out, and then people will flock around the world because, oh, that's the statue of Mary that's crying here and going there, and legend, and whole towns, their entire commercial business springs up because they got a crying. I saw one statue of Mary and had a sign that said out of order on it. I thought, oh, that's, I didn't show that. I don't want to offend you like that, but I thought, really? Is that what we're chasing down now? And then there's the, I don't know if you know this, but if you go anywhere through kind of Europe where there's a lot of medieval cathedrals and stuff, you'll see that in the artistry that's there presented to the populace, in a time when people couldn't read the Bible, they relied on the icons, the imagery, the statues, the carvings, the paintings to teach them lessons. And in so many of the lessons, it was the saints that hold Jesus. And basically they're saying, we got Jesus. If you want something from him, you got to come through us. You got to pray to us. You got to use the church, and you have to come through us because we got power to ask him for stuff. You got no right. So you pray to us. We got him held captive. So many images of holding the baby Jesus. Now, if you want to ridicule the supernatural in that way, I'm on your side. Because I think that's foolish. That's unbiblical silliness. There's also multitudes of other religions in the world that believe by doing certain acts, burning certain incense, wearing certain clothes, eating certain food, not eating other certain food, going on certain trips, wearing this, we're going there, all kinds of physical things that are going to somehow attract the attention of the unknown, of the spiritual, and then you're going to get better crops, better outcomes, better life, better finances. Somehow it's going to get better by those trickeries. Now, there's also things that we see even today. There are faith healers. This is a guy from South America that is a spiritual surgeon. And if you are fortunate enough, because there are thousands of people lining up and paying money for the opportunity for this guy to have a look at their spiritual problem, then he will reach spiritually into your body and remove from you whatever ill or evil is causing you problems. Now, they prey on weak-minded people who are desperate because of their physical problems. And that, if you want to mock that, I will get the tomatoes and join you. Okay? So, why do people today insist on removing the supernatural? Are they right? Now, I agree that there's a lot of stuff that needs to be sorted out. But the big problem with the supernatural, the miraculous, as a proof of God, is that you can't repeat it in the lab. For scientific things to be validated, you have to be able to repeat them hundreds and hundreds of times under the same conditions so that you can prove, yes, God is there because we asked for this miracle and got it. Bing, boom, on. It just happens. And if you can do that all the time, now here's the problem with miracles. They're up to God. They're up to God. They're not up to you. You don't have a technique that can twist God's arm. His arm is too big for twisting. So there's nothing that you can do. Therefore, there's no way that you can repeat the miracle again and again and again to be proven as accurate. In fact, I think that if you kind of went, well, I'm going to prove God exists by going out and doing this, I think God just might let you hang. Because he is not your boy. You work for him. So I want to just look at this miracle here. Now, this is what it's known as. It's the chance occurrence under lab conditions of H2O becoming H2O and tartaric acid, malic acid, lactic acid, phenols and polyphenols, anthocyanins, stibloids, flavonoids, pristhactinins, etc., chitinases, proteins, glucose, fructose, sucrose, along with arbenose, raminose, and xylose, yeast-assimilable nitrogen, which, of course, we call them YANs, the free amino nitrogens, ammonia and ammonium minerals, of course, for flavor, and a little bit of CO2 for bubbly. Or you also might know it as turning water into wine. Ah, I'm so disappointed. Do you know how hard it is to get that information? And you're all like, haha, that was funny. So we're going to read this story because I think this properly demonstrates Jesus' understanding of the miraculous, how it's to be used, and what it ultimately means. And so we're going to read from John chapter 2, and starting at verse 1. It says, on the third day there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And Jesus was invited to the wedding with his disciples. And when the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. And Jesus said to her, woman, just don't do that with your mom. Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. Now there were 6 stone jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. That's a lot of water. And Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast. So they took it. And when the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, although the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, everyone serves the good wine at the feast, and when the people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you kept the good wine until now. This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. I find this story just so perfect in the way that Jesus has gone with the disciples and his mother to a wedding that he probably would have been invited for family reasons too. And at the wedding, the most embarrassing social situation has come up, which is that we ran out of festival wine. The whole wedding is going to be ruined. Embarrassment galore. So Mary goes to Jesus and says, Jesus, can you fix this? And Jesus goes, this is not my time. Now, first thing, Mary knows that Jesus is capable of the miraculous. And she tries to make the miraculous happen. And Jesus says, no, the miraculous is always subject to my purposes in this world. I'm capable of any kind of miraculous thing. But my miraculous works are only for one purpose. They are not to satisfy the material needs, the wedding party needs of a group of people who are already drunk. They are not just for you to take advantage of because you got my ear so that you can get what you need to service your group of friends. No, my miracles are for the purpose of bringing glory and attention to myself so that people can be saved. So Jesus does this whole thing. Now, the only problem with this picture is like you got kind of Jesus doing that sort of science guy thing where he's standing up, right, oh, water here, do that, waving the magic wand. That's actually not accurate to the story. In the story, Jesus is like in the back. They come to him and say, Jesus, can you fix it? And he's like, no, it's not my time, not my time. All right, mom, all right. I'll find a way to make this work. So he just says, go fill it up with water. No wavy wand thing. He says, just go do it. And they fill it up, and they go, okay, that was kind of dumb. Go take it to the master. Spoon, a scoopy, all righty. Now, the master doesn't know what's going on. He's just like, hey, this is good stuff, fantastic vintage, amazing. I love this. I'm going to write the beer commercial for it. We'll have lots of people running it. No, he's just like, he's enjoying this whole thing, but he has no idea how it's going. The only people who know what's happening is the disciples and a couple of servants. Nobody else knows. And that's the reason that Jesus did this miracle. Not so that everyone could get a bunch of wine. This, the first signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. The whole purpose for the miraculous and the genuine supernatural is to draw people's attention to Jesus Christ, because by believing Jesus, you will have salvation. The miracle is not the most important thing. The miracle worker is. Right? The miracle, like Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, but he died later. Right? He died again. They didn't just wake him up, shock therapy. You know, like Lazarus is not 2,000 years ago. Every time he dies, raise him again. And like, drag Lazarus out. Let's prove that. No. The purpose of that was to reveal Jesus' glory. And in fact, all of the book of John, he says, now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples that are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. The whole purpose of miracles is to reveal Jesus Christ so that you can find salvation in him, because the miraculous takes care of the temporary things. We need the eternal. We need the eternal life, not a body that constantly needs to be healed, but the eternal glorified body in Christ. Does that make sense? So why do people insist today on removing the supernatural? Well, ultimately because of what it leads to. When God does genuine acts of power, people become alert to the fact that God is alive. If God is alive and he's real, then you just might have something to do with him. You might have something that you need to account to him. And if he's real, then you can't ignore him. So it's easier to discredit the miraculous so that you don't have to face up to the reality of God. So Jesus was very, very careful. I don't know if you know this. He was very careful of his use of miracles. Let me just read you this passage here, which shows Jesus doing the miraculous at an incredible over-the-top rate. He goes, and he went through all of Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every disease and every affliction, every among the people. So his fame spread throughout Syria, and they brought him all the sick, those affected with various diseases and pains, those oppressed by demons, epileptics, paralytics, and he healed them all. I think that Matthew's editing. He doesn't even know all the different diseases that showed up. He's just kind of like, you name it, somebody brought somebody like that. They put him in front of Jesus. You got grandma, she's a paralytic. You bounced her in front of Jesus. She bounced well. She just boing, and then she walked away. Like, there was a long stream. You brought anyone to Jesus. There was no stopping it all night long. That's crazy. And then take that story of an unlimited miraculous flow to this story here in Matthew chapter 12. It says, then some of the scribes and the Pharisees answered, saying, teacher, we wish to see a sign from you. So he answered them, well, an evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign. Hint. But no sign will be given except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a great fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. When Jesus was pressed, hey, Jesus, prove it to me. Prove it to us. Make sure that we will absolutely be overwhelmed with this miraculous stuff. Make sure. I want to be able to pull you in front of the Sanhedrin and say, Jesus, do a miracle. He does a miracle. Do another one. He does another one. We want to make sure that this is absolutely certain and we can prove it to ourselves and we can take you on tour and this is going to be great. And Jesus goes, nah, not one. Well, can you just like change the weather? No. Can you bless my child? Not because you asked. No. And then he sneaky blessed a child. He's kind of like that. They used to set him up with healings so he could be too tempted to heal. But everything was in control by Jesus for the purpose of bringing glory to himself so that people might be saved through him. He was not going to use the miracles to reinforce people's falsehoods about him. Now, In the Bible, the use of miracles becomes a difficulty. When Jesus entered a house, the blind men came to him. Now, they'd been following him down the road. He does nothing for them in public. when the blind man came to him, Jesus said, "Do you believe that I'm able to do this?" And they said to him, "Yes, Lord." Then he touched their eyes, saying, "According to your faith, be it done for you." And their eyes were open. And then Jesus sternly warned them, "See that no one knows about it." And they went away and spread his fame throughout all the district. Teenagers. They don't listen. Like, are you kidding me? Jesus purposely, imagine this, that Jesus controls the use of the supernatural so that it does not become a fame thing. Because he knows that crowds of people looking for signs are not disciples. And he wants you to become a disciple of him. So he actually goes, "Okay, blind guys, I'll heal you, but please don't tell anyone." They go and blab, and the problems that arise from their blabbing makes it difficult for Jesus to do his ministry. Because he's not just somebody that's a trinket, a rabbit's foot, that does things whenever you ask him to. There was division among the Jews because of these words. Many of them said, "He's got a demon and is insane. Why listen to him?" Others said, "These are not the words of one who's oppressed by a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind?" There was constant division in the community because of Jesus' use of the miraculous. It becomes crucial to his ministry. The Jews picked up stones against him. Jesus said to them, "I've shown you many good works from the fathers. Which of them are you about to stone me?" Oh, yeah, I know. It's probably, I know. When I kill those blind guys, you went, "That's too far. Come on, that's showy. You're going to stone me to death for that one?" Jesus is like, "Here's the thing. You're stoning me because I do miracles. Use the logic on that. I do miracles." And they're like, we want to kill you because you're in the way of our desires, but we can't kill you because you're the guy that does miracles, so what are we going to do? Stop doing miracles, please. Nah, I'm not going to hide myself. So the crowd that had been with him when they called Lazarus out from the tomb and raised him from the dead continued to bear witness. The reason why the crowd went to meet him was that they heard that he had done this sign. So the Pharisees said to one another, "See, we're gaining nothing. Look, the world has gone, all the world has gone after him." And they plot to kill Lazarus and Jesus because the signs were pointing to Christ, Jesus, and they didn't want Jesus to be the center. Now, why do people today insist on removing the supernatural? Because of what it leads to. The miraculous is confronting. And that's the best thing about the miraculous. But they don't always convince. John 12:37, though he had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe in him. I want to just tell you a few stories. Just because I can. I'm here, you're listening, you're sort of awake. A couple of weeks ago, our good friend David Platt had a heart attack. Had a little tiny one at home. Just a little warm-up heart attack. He doesn't want to pull a muscle. So he just has a little tiny warm-up heart attack, and he just feels like it's right to go to the hospital. When he gets to the hospital, he has a full-on heart attack in the hospital. The doctors and the nursing staff said, if this had happened to you when you were at home, you would have died. But it happened to him in the hospital. Miraculous? Very. A couple of years ago, I went